Ask people who meditate why they do it, and their answers may surprise. They say it helps keep them healthy, increases mental acuity, decreases stress, and even improves creativity. But for those who have never tried it before, meditation seems an impossible task. With questions like, what is it, how do I start, and even, am I doing it right? The new book, The Power of Meditation, An Ancient Technique to Access Your Inner Power, has just been written by Edward Felhoun. He joins us this morning. The book looks to answer those questions as well as many other concerns. Edward, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me here today.
It is very nice to have you with us. What got you interested in the power of meditation?
Exactly what you opened with. I had heard the promises of what meditation could do, and I wanted that. But as I enrolled in classes to learn how, what I discovered was all the blocks that everybody does in, that everybody encounters, such as that busy mind that gets in the way of any quiet space whatsoever. And also I discovered I had an inability to imagine all of the visualizations that were presented to me in class. So after a short while of trying to learn to meditate, I came to a full stop and thinking there was something broken about my ability to meditate, until I heard a student in a class that I was sitting with saying, you know, when you ask me to close my eyes and visualize a stream and a forest, I see nothing. And in that moment, I realized, there are other people struggling just like I am. And I embarked on a journey of trying to find a method that would work for me, that wouldn't leave me feeling left out in the cold.
What do you think there is about the whole concept of meditation that makes it difficult to teach?
I think there is an addiction to urgency in our mind. I used to say that before meditation, my mind was running around without adult supervision. And now with meditation, I found a way to give that part of my mind that is addicted to urgency, that is very reactive, I give it space to do what it needs to do. But at the same time, I also have a regular appointment with sitting quietly, so that quiet wisdom that is below the surface of all of that reactivity and fast-paced thinking can have its airtime as well.
Give us an idea of how you describe the spiritual in this, in the sense that it can be a part of anyone's belief system, correct?
I think so. I think that just the simple act of sitting still doesn't require any particular faith tradition. Just in sitting still, we get to meet what is below the surface noise of our day-to-day thinking, and you don't need to insert any particular faith tradition or spiritual meaning to that. I think the spiritual meaning will come out of the sitting still itself. So I don't really require anybody to change their belief system or religion in order to learn to meditate. I do notice, however, that people who do meditate develop a deeper relationship with their religion of origin or the one that they're currently practicing.
Why do you think that is? Is it because of the time and the silence that is involved?
I think it's because they create some space to think about what they believe. I think people are often taught what to believe, but not necessarily given the instruction or the opportunity to think about what they believe. So in quietness, they can develop a new relationship with the big questions of their faith. Sometimes I even encourage people in meditation to take a central concept of their faith tradition, even the word God, for example, and sit with it quietly to see what rises up in them. And in that quietness, they often come to a more solid articulation of what they believe.
You talk in the book, and I found this fascinating, that while the practice is while we call things meditation, there are many ways to practice it, creative ways to practice meditation. And you even look at the book of using writing techniques toward meditation.
Yes. You mentioned earlier how sometimes people don't know how to do it, or they don't know if they're doing it right. And that's because there's no one size fits all to the way we engage with our mind. For some people, it's very, very difficult to sit still and do nothing. For other people, as soon as they do something with their hands, their minds become quiet. So I noticed that when I give people something to do, and it changes from person to person, for example, journaling is one. For another, it might be counting beads into a bowl. And for yet another, it might be watching a kettle boil. When I give them something to engage in, it prevents their mind running off in a direction in a way that it will if you just say to them, sit still and think about nothing. So now there's a line that they need to monitor themselves when they become more obsessed in the activity, more engaged in the activity than they are engaged in mindfully watching their own thought process as they do whatever they're doing. The beauty of journaling is that it slows down thinking. So when I write, this amazing organizing power of my mind takes my thoughts and channels it through my hand and writes it down on the paper, and there captured in a still form on the paper is a thought, and now I can look at that thought. And that is so different from just mentally looking at my thoughts, because my thoughts tend to move at the speed of lightning. You know, once it's thought, a thought is thought, it's gone, and then the next one, tailgating on that. So when I write it down, it slows it down, and in that slowing down, there's a more mindful opportunity to think about what was passing through my mind.
And it doesn't have to be one or the other, right? All of these can be used at one time or another.
Yes, especially if you're the sort of person like me, I like a variety of experiences, so I like to use them all.
When you are teaching this, and I guess that is what is so important to get out of what you're saying is that it can be taught. As a teacher, what challenges do you come up against the most?
Yeah, I think that the biggest challenge is the noise that people experience in their own mind. So if they have a very busy mind or they're agitated by some life challenge, when they're asked to sit still, what happens is they begin to think about that challenge. And so that moment of quietness becomes something that's additionally troubling. So to give them something to do in the beginning to slow down their thinking or to create peace is the objective. It's so much easier to do in a group setting than it is on one-on-one. Because when I'm in a group setting, I can say to people, all right, just let's take a moment to be still. And I don't give them any additional instruction about how to do that. In fact, giving them too much instruction often complicates it. I just say, let's take a moment to be still. And we can feel the room becoming still. It's almost as if a gear is being shifted. And then afterwards, I ask them what happened. And that's how the instruction begins for meditation. They start to think about what happened and how they felt. They start looking inside at what shifted, connecting it with the feeling of peace, and that way they start to trace their own way to their quiet mind.
The name of the book is The Power of Meditation, an ancient technique to access your inner power. The book is published by Tarcher Penguin. Edward Fulhun, thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, The Power of Meditation. It is published by Penguin. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.